been known for many years as a blind JFK researcher specializing in intelligence agency involvement in multiple assassinations, propaganda, and other global criminal operations in the 20th and 21st centuries.
Your listeners are extremely fortunate to have you.
And now the most underrated voice in all media.
Chuck O'Kelly! Yeah!
29th day of August 2019, allegedly according to that thing we call a calendar, and this indeed is the O'Kelly Effect, broadcast live, originating from the facilities of O'Kelly.com, but you know what, we're heard in a lot of other places, and starting in September, sometime we'll be coming to you out of Columbia, South Carolina, so there you go. A couple other additional AM and FM stations are in the works, so to speak, so you never know. As a matter of fact, if you contact me, if you got some idea about a way that you would like to sponsor, let's say, because you're a listener of this show and you'd like it to be available to you locally on the AM or FM level, let me know by sending an email to info@ocelli.com, and I will be more than happy to investigate this. Because, a little bit of money, a little bit of sponsorship, and boom, we can be all over the place in a big, big hurry. So, but we are worldwide live anyway on the internet. We are rebroadcast and broadcast and simulcast in a bunch of different places. So good evening to you, no matter where it is, who you are, where you are. And if you're catching this further on down the stream via your fondle slab of choice, your applicable application, you are equally welcome. So now that I've gotten all that out of the way, it is a Thursday, that's right, and guess what? It is that every other Thursday that brings us Carmine Savastano, the author of Two Princes and a King, the guy behind the website TPAAK.com. Now, that does seem like it makes sense, doesn't it? Because it stands for Two Princes and a King, but there's a whole lot more over there. Now, Two Princes and a King is the book which gives you a concise review of three assassinations from the 1960s, but there's a lot more than that over at TPOC.com, and we've talked about it on here a lot, and hey, let's get to it. Carmine, how are you doing tonight?
I'm doing good, Chuck. Good to be back.
I'm bracing myself for the storm they're calling Dorian, because not quite sure how much of Georgia's going to get pummeled by it. Florida's definitely about to get hit, and hey, the Trumpster said he's going to stay home from going to Poland, so good news there, I guess, he says with a bit of sarcasm loaded. It is what it is, but we'll see what happens with the flooding and everything else. I mean, hey, I'm sure I'll be in good enough shape to come back again when you're due to come back on the show, but who knows? We could have interruptions in the flow of things here.
Yeah, I'm hoping that you – well, you know, hopefully everybody gets spared, but, you know, if Florida's going to be hit, hopefully Georgia gets spared.
Yeah, well, that's the thing. I mean, look, it is hurricane season, and look, again, I know we have listeners in Florida, and I hope that you guys are safe. You've stocked up on water. You're ready to go. Not too many listeners in Georgia, but I'm here, so it is what it is. We'll see what happens.
That will affect the other listeners.
That will affect other people, maybe. the hurricane or the tropical storm or whatever it is, that's what's really, really in the news at the moment, along with the other madness. But we're going to go into a bit of history tonight and continue on, actually, with, you know, I really feel good about the last episode we did regarding the it kind of turned into an evolution of the FBI, sort of. But your initial intent was to focus on one particular agency, which most people never bother to look at. Some of the inner workings, if you will, of the modern agencies are based on these evolutions. And I really feel like we need to do a part two on that one, by the way.
SIS.
Yeah, the SIS, exactly. And you know, there's a lot of these little, again, agencies in the alphabet soup world that people forget about, that, yeah, you know, that
failed,
did exist.
The failed attempts
or possibly the baby steps. You know, you don't walk around the same way you did when you were a toddler, do you? Because you learned to walk better, and maybe you call it by a different name. At that time, it was called cruising, right? Now you actually get to walk around, or if you're me, you need three legs because you got a cane. So it is what it is. But you know what I'm saying? It's like things change over time. And but it's interesting to look at the history because it does give you an insight into the behaviors of the existing agencies, I believe. And also it's a solid history lesson, especially when people want to go look back at certain events, investigations, the behavior of the agency. Why does this agency compete with this one? Why is it that it seems like the same names are here and here? Well, sometimes it actually makes perfect bureaucratic sense if you take a look at the way the agencies were developed. And actually, you're going to touch on something tonight, which I have to admit, I do not have any strength. As far as I'm concerned, I couldn't give a presentation on this. So this ought to be interesting. I believe I'll be learning along with the listeners. And so there you go. Anything else you want to get to before we get started, Carmine?
I suppose, I don't know. I'll try to just do a quick something to say before we dive right into it. So as Chuck was saying, it is interesting to look at the evolution of these various agencies. And like I said, some of them I look at as kind of like failed attempts, you know, almost like a growth spurt would, as Chuck said, turn them into something else. But these are like the old evolutions. These are the – maybe if we were to look back and find the skeletons of a troglodyte or the skeletons of Cro-Magnon man, these are the earlier evolutions that didn't work, that had to be phased out, SIS. And then this group that we're going to talk about tonight would be another like that.
Right. And, you know, again, it's not necessarily – I feel it's unfair to say that they were phased out because they were failures, though. In some cases, I think what they did is they built a facility that didn't have to be a separate attachment. You know, it's like, let's just make this part of the game.
Well, that's true. Redundancy, definitely. And you're going to see that tonight, too, just like you do with the SIS. I think it's a case-by-case basis. I think that you're right in some cases where with SIS where it actually did have a use. But in other groups, like, let's say, what we're going to discuss tonight, you know, there was – not only was it a redundancy, but it was just not successful overall. Like it well, it just didn't achieve the same success rates that some of the other groups did.
See, but if that wasn't the case, then we wouldn't have grown to 16 agencies, you know what I mean, as far as – because there always had to be failures, right? Even the most mainstream of mainstream people when they're discussing this kind of stuff will say, look, there were failures of intelligence. There were failures on the part of the investigative agency. There were failures on the part of the policing in certain cases. I mean, and again, it is a case-by-case basis, and I think it is worthy to examine these things, which no longer exist, to wrap your mind around all of the possibilities regarding how these agencies behave. Once again, you know, if you think about it, the Bureau of the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms was not always the way it is today, right? The ATF, as it exists, at one time was the Bureau of Alcohol and Tobacco, and then they put firearms in there. I would love to have been in on the meeting as to why all of that came together exactly, because I've always found that agency remarkable too. You know, real quick before we start on this one, what do you think about that? Isn't that one of those kind of like makes you scratch your head a minute? Like, how is it that they put firearms, tobacco, and alcohol together exactly? Except that the prohibitions.
Yeah, that would be to me the one time I could see that those three would work together.
Yeah, I mean, see, during prohibition, it makes sense. But the funny thing is, like, tobacco, to my knowledge, has never been illegal. Right, in this country now, if you attempt to evade taxes with tobacco, you know, then it's a matter of tax evasion, and you figure, well, why doesn't the IRS deal with it or something like that? I mean,
they're the three that provide the highest amount of fines to the government.
See, that's the thing, though. That's a revenue generating machine. But I mean, logically speaking, like from a pragmatic standpoint, you would think that firearms, right, you have a regulated and unregulated black market. Alcohol, at one time, you had an unregulated black market. But, I mean, and the truth is, I mean, there's still people making illegal booze. But, quite frankly, it's not a big deal at this point. You know, microbreweries born in somebody's garage are common, and that would be, you know, highly illegal if alcohol was illegal. See, it's a taxation issue. Firearms, though, like I said, you have a significant black market and then a significant legitimate market. And, you know what I'm saying? It's almost like even the postures of the policing seem almost at odds with each other.
Yeah. Yeah, there's certainly a vague area in between those three subjects.
Yeah, that's what I'm thinking. But anyway, tonight's subject is not going to be so vague. And again, like I said, I'm going to actually learn a little bit because, frankly, I ignored this particular agency. So, and it's not like I don't acknowledge it. It's just that it just didn't really strike me as something to be studied. So I'm very sure that what Carmine's going to do is going to be quite enlightening here. So let's get started if you're ready.
Okay. Pond scum is defined as both the overgrowth of algae on top of stagnant water, and it also refers to contemptible people. The scum develops because of the very still waters beneath it that are likely to attract unhealthy elements, because it does not receive enough sunlight. Growing shadows obfuscate sources of light to block any clear view of the accelerating process, and this causes many healthy creatures in the pond to sicken or die. Eventually, only some kinds of life can be sustained in this habitat, and it becomes a brackish and toxic environment for many other creatures. A person or an intelligence group can also operate for too long in a still environment, undisturbed by the rays of normal regulation and oversight. Just as in the natural environment, a person or a group that acts with impunity and receives few checks to their power will abuse it. It is likely not a question of if, but when they shall do so. The United States, similar to most industrialized nations, has no shortage of ambitious officials, with its government that sought to expand their influence and power based on ideological reasoning such as J. Edgar Hoover, William Donovan, John Foster Dulles, and James Angleton are just some of the varied people who greatly influenced and changed parts of the American government and groups they operated within. Most would state in the morass of conflicting interests we have prior discussed that include such associations as the CIA, OSS, FBI, and SIS, how much deeper can American intelligence extend? While the United States is a relatively young world power, its penchant for innovation during the years of world wars have sparked many new groups. So perhaps one of the most and longest concealed American intelligence groups files were those of the Pond, an intelligence group created to counterweight the OSS by America's military.
Okay, hold on a second. Now, let's be very clear. But first of all, bonus points, and anybody who's listening to this ought to give bonus points to Carmine's presentation immediately for beginning with a definition of pond scum. That is hilarious, but... You know,
glad you enjoyed it.
Well, no, I think that's great. But why is it? Let me just begin with this. The pond. Somebody might think that this is just a nickname for a particular agency. Maybe it's it stands for something. The partnership on non-domestic criminals. I don't know, whatever, Ponzi. Almost sounds like Ponzi. But, you know, here we go, right? There might be a lot of interpretations there. Why can you begin with why it is it's called the Pond?
Well, from some of the documents and a couple of the interviews and a little bit of what we'll learn, some of the leader's diary, the depth. It's a reference to the depth that they were seeking to go. They were basically dealing in secret intelligence, and they were trying to form an ultra-secret group, as where the OSS – one of the jokes some of the people in the pond made about the OSS was that their initials stood – that the acronym stood for OSO Social.
Ah.
Because they were always in the newspaper. Well, so they took the opposite view that you should never be known to anyone.
So the pond is like a sort of an in-house name. It's not really like – I guess they would file it today under this name, though, don't they?
Yeah, what happened was is they had original I have it in my notes somewhere, just trying to find it.
I'm making you skip ahead, aren't I?
A little bit.
I'm sorry.
It's fine. I think special planning. What was the name of it? I'll come to it.
No worries.
Basically, there was an official. There were a couple official names actually for it, but eventually, even officials just started calling it the Pond. No one called it by the official name anymore.
Okay. So very much like what we call the Warren Commission today. That's not its official title by any means.
Yeah, but they refer to it like that.
It is. Even in government hearings today, somebody will say the Warren Commission. they will not bother with telling you it's the President's Commission on assassination, you know.
Yeah, the assassination of President Kennedy.
Right. They're not going to do that. They're not going to give you the proper name because this is the name it becomes known by. Okay, no, I wanted to clarify that right off the bat, though, because some people might say the pond, oh, what are we talking about, just some in-house joke here that was among just a certain group of people. I wanted to make it clear that it actually is something that if you go to look it up now, you will find information on it under that heading. But it wasn't originally the name of it. So go ahead.
Okay.
And that just about ends most of what I know about this subject. So go ahead.
So Donovan's OSS was a more liberal organization that engaged in sometimes questionable operations, and its critics were correct in asserting it had several enemy spies within its circles and ranks. However, instead of further oversight and strict controls, the more right-wing-leaning military commanders believed a separate group guided by different political biases were in order. Among the military critics was the future leader of the Pond, John V. Grombach,
okay,
who later Central Intelligence Agency reports called a, quote, true believer, and one author has called pro-fascist. John Valentin Grombach was born in 1901 in the 12th Ward of New Orleans to French immigrants and was legally considered a citizen of France. He would later forego any claim to French citizenship and was naturalized before attending West Point Academy. He joined the U.S. Army as a cadet and rose to captain in the summer of 1923, and interestingly, while he did attend West Point Military Academy, participate in its boxing program, and would graduate, a history of insubordination demerits prevented him from receiving a military command.
Okay.
Similar to the more freewheeling William Donovan and the earlier Walter Bedell Smith, Grombach was a man who desired to follow his own will to the detriment of his critics. According to one agency history, Grombach was able to acquire a command following his graduation from West Point and spent multiple years serving as a military police officer. He was stationed in the Panama Canal Zone in the position of provost marshal and served as a military intelligence assistant. This would begin a long relationship with G2 that subsequently would allow him to expand his intelligence background and lead him to future endeavors. He left regular army service in the late 1920s, but maintained a role in the New York National Guard and gained employment with Paramount Publix, a company that produced radio shows.
Now, again, really quickly, this would be post-World War I, right?
Yeah.
Because it would have ended by then. We inserted earlier on there. And so this would have been leading into, you know, that little area there where we weren't participating in the action, let's say. But this is that rather interesting time period. And just before the stock market crash, too. So that's kind of an interesting juxtaposition for this guy to be, you know, there and having the history he's got and looking at his later career. I think we should trace that along that timeline, you know, the significant events that are occurring during that time period as well. So go ahead.
Yeah. And I think that we can also see that the what will, you know, come to, you'll learn more as we go more into Grombach. He, like a lot of the people at the time, I think, was unaware of the extent of the lead that the Soviets had on the West as far as intelligence went.
Right.
Because at this point, you know, they've already got – well, they already had the Royal Secret Police, but that's been transformed into the Bolshevik version. And, you know, they have a lot of time on us as far as developing methods of policing, secret policing and intelligence and assassination and all those things. So
we talked about this in brief when we talked about Vladimir Putin and put him in context as a rising star in the GRU. Which came much later, but you had to kind of lay that groundwork in order to get there. I'm just saying, we kind of have been over this too. Good.
I was just going to say KGB.
Oh, right. Sorry.
I do it all the time. There's so many acronyms.
Yeah. I meant to say KGB and then I went GRU. You know, but the thing is with Putin, I think he's got bona fides with both, but KGB would be the thing, right?
Yeah, so. yeah, yeah, abbreviations, acronyms, and that's another abbreviations, acronyms.
Right. Just saying. Anyway, and in Russian it gets weirder, so. Anyway, go ahead.
Okay, well, that's one of the few things I'm proud of. Komitat Gosudarstvennoy Benzopoznosti. That's the actual name.
Nice.
That's one of the few Russian things I can say.
Perfect. All right, go ahead.
If they ever arrest me, I'll be able to name their defunct intelligence agency.
Nice.
Supposedly defunct. Now it's just called the FSB and whatever else.
Yeah, that's true. And, you know, funny thing is the Russians stopped attacking my website just for everybody's knowledge.
Nice.
Now it's the Chinese.
They tagged them in?
It seems like a whole lot of Chinese IP addresses just are trying to do funky things to the website. Just I like to announce that every once in a while that I'm well aware of the things you guys are doing security wise. So, you know, and yeah, go ahead. And by the way, welcome to our nondescript United States listeners who are listening live tonight. I don't know where you are. I'm gonna guess though that since it's putting you in the middle of the ocean, you're not actually there. So, anyway, greetings. Go ahead.
He's live from the Red October.
Something like that, yeah.
So Grumbach, he is a military police officer. He gets stationed in the Panama-Canal zone, hooking up with military intelligence. And then he quickly, as a radio producer, creates several radio programs that he parlays into multiple production companies of his own. He additionally was covertly working for the U.S. State Department during 1937 and was pushing for innovations in radio warfare that used broadcasted messages with secret purposes similar to number stations and propaganda outlets used by various countries around the world. Mm. Now, but then it would have been a totally new invasion. In 1941, Grumbach was readmitted into the Army at the rank of captain and assigned to the 27th Infantry Division. And following the aftermath of Pearl Harbor, he was recommended for the U.S. Army's G2 Military Intelligence Organization, bringing him to the American capital. Grumbach proved an able intelligence officer and was loaned during a portion of 1942 for use by the Coordinator of Information's office, led by William Donovan, shortly before it would transition into the Office of Strategic Services.
Ah, okay. Well, there's an interesting crossroads.
Exactly. No, you're going to see more of those, of some of the names we've discussed. It is going to be interesting, I think, to see how, you know, no matter how their success rate was, the pond was firmly in the middle of all this.
Okay. Go ahead.
Grumbach was literally on the ground floor to observe Donovan's successes and failures in the earliest days of the transition. Simultaneously, the United States War Department was also creating a new secret intelligence group as the possible counterweight to the OSS. While the military and civilian departments had agreed to allow Donovan purview over gathering intelligence, quote, in early 1942, the jealousies and complaints of various agencies coalesced into a serious move to dismember Donovan's group. The Joint Chiefs of Staff adopted as their position a proposal to abolish the COI and distribute most of its parts to the Joint Chiefs of Staff and their services. Under the proposal, the fate of the secret intelligence function would be decided in consultations between the Chiefs and the State Department. In this little-mentioned proposal, we can again observe some of the backbiting and political wrangling Donovan faced that we prior discussed on the show covering the OSS. The Joint Chiefs did not want challenges to their influence and power and were considering dividing up the COI before the OSS existed. The related history – I'm sorry, do you want to say something?
No, I just said that that's interesting right there. Is before the OSS even took shape, got this going.
Yeah, the one that destroyed Donovan.
Yeah, go ahead.
The related history continues, quote, the Army's G2 Major General George Strong was one of the most committed to disestablishing the COI while he attempted to move in on Donovan's turf by creating his own intelligence service. More discreet than COI, it was to operate cooperatively with the State Department and undercut the rationale for a COI clandestine collection unit. So not only were they going after Donovan, they were designing things expressly to undercut him.
Mm.
An interesting consideration is that if military leaders succeeded similar to J. Edgar Hoover's designs for the Special Intelligence Service, the destruction of COI would have prevented later intelligence groups from existing and placed too much control exclusively in the hands of the U.S. military and State Department.
Hmm. Okay.
So that is one thing to consider these days, is that it could possibly be smaller than it is now, but that all that might be concentrated in the hands of just those groups.
Well,
so we might mega structure to the State Department.
Yeah, and I mean today with the I hate to call it an innovation, but the totality of government sort of intelligence design that went into the State Department, most notably during the time that Secretary Clinton is in charge. Quite honestly, you can see how that this is not hard to do, considering the access that everything winds up going through the State Department at some point.
Yeah.
Okay. It's pretty much that simple. Every one of these agencies that we wind up having to discuss, the State Department has to deal with it. So it's kind of a pragmatic move to kind of have the State Department utilize every last one of these intelligence agencies too, which is weird because, you know, we've discussed how a State Department, legitimate attachés, let's just say, through the State Department wind up being utilized in order to secrete basically various intelligence operatives into different areas of the world, into different circumstances, so on and so forth. So I think that's an interesting thing to always keep in mind when we're examining this stuff. Go ahead.
Well, and I think that's a good note, and that we can see that the origin of some of these activities that we see the CIA doing now started with the POND.
Right.
Not with the OSS.
Right.
But the POND, because it's, as we shall learn, a less successful and less respected group, probably doesn't get a lot of the things it did get right aren't remembered.
Right. And the thing is, again, as we stated during the discussion on the OSS, I mean, most people would simply credit the OSS as being the forerunner. That's it. The OSS became the CIA, according to a lot of people, which is not precisely true. But
there's two steps in between, at least.
Yeah, right. There's a few things going on there. And, yes, some of what the OSS was consumed by the CIA for sure. But it's not like the basis for the CIA is really, truly based on the OSS, in my opinion, anyway. I would say that there were a great many other things that came together to formulate what the CIA becomes, not just its charter, but the realities of it, okay?
So well, I think the POND will show, you know, over the discussion, we'll see that the POND played part of that role.
There you go. So go ahead.
Okay, so Strong would order the chief of military intelligence to form this envisioned group, but that did not prevent the rise of the OSS, which I think is another interesting consideration, is that ultimately, though there are a lot of other fights going on and, you know, internal structure, power battles, this really is egos. This is some of the Joint Chiefs and Donovan fighting.
Well, see, I wonder if, you know, you don't just have a combination of egos here, but you also have, I don't know, maybe a...
territoriality.
Territoriality, yeah. Sure, but also an experimentation, a period of experimentation where, as you stated at the beginning, we were woefully behind the some other world powers. I mean, I would say that British intelligence was far superior to ours. You know, not just enemy intelligence groups like the KGB, but, I mean, various intelligence groups were more evolved, had greater infrastructures, had greater reach. I feel as though this is a time period where somebody on the, you know, macroscopic level looked at this and said, let's experiment a little and let these guys actually fight it out and see, you know, whose ideas really do prevail in a real world sense. Because there is a lot of redundancy that winds up arising during this time period, between World War I, quite frankly, and in the 1950s, I mean, there's just a ton of stuff going on, and it seems to me like somebody might have thought on a, you know, again, on a more, not quite global, but like I said, macroscopic kind of level, let's see if these guys can establish something and create something, fast track it by allowing the experimentation to go on. What do you think of that?
I think that's possible, maybe for some presidents or maybe a few secretaries of state. But
right.
I don't think about the Joint Chiefs. I don't think they thought like that.
Oh, no, no, no. I'm not saying that the Joint Chiefs would have thought this way. What I'm saying is that somebody in power or a group of somebodies, there might have even been an understanding, like handing off the baton between different presidents. You know, in a lot of cases, these guys, they always have a meeting before a new president takes the office, right?
Yeah.
And we know this, and it's usually to, like, brief, and there's always that, you know, photo op that we've gotten used to, okay, are the Obamas going to invite the Trumps into the White House and so on. Sure, we've gotten used to that. Are the Bushes going to invite the Obamas in, or, you know, are the Clintons going to invite the Bushes in, so on and so forth, right? But the truth is they have these meetings, and I think in some cases they also hand off certain things to each other. And during this time period, I'm not saying that I have any sort of proof for this, but it just seems illogical that that certain presidents might have said, listen, we're still in the midst of developing our intelligence capabilities. We don't want the rest of the world to know about it, but let's do this. Understand that you're going to have to put up with, you know, some issues here. You might have to get rid of some agencies or create them or allow people to run their own shops here for a little bit and see what actually sticks. I can imagine that that sort of thing would go on in the executive branch one way or another, whether you're talking about the, you know, the State Department guys handing off to each other or, you know, or the bureaucrats informing the new Secretary of State or the president being informed, listen, this is what's happening and, you know, maybe you should continue to experiment until you find what makes a lot of sense. I mean, what do you think of that?
Well, what's maybe most frightening is I don't think it happened with presidents. I do think it happened with lower officials because in some of the CIA documents, they do talk about for plausible deniability, they will not tell the president some projects.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
So I'm sure that the worst things weren't told.
Well, see, but that's the thing. That's why I wanted to ask you this question because – because quite honestly, most people would think, you know, given the whole, all right, look, let's get down to brass tacks. When Kennedy's coming in, everybody knows the story of, hey, listen, we got this Bay of Pigs thing ready for you. You know, everybody knows that kind of story, right? So the idea that a lot of things are handed off is true.
Oh, certainly. Policy. I mean, look at Vietnam.
Yeah.
Eisenhower, Kennedy, Johnson, Nixon, four far different presidents. All doing the exact same thing.
Yeah, exactly. And but that's the thing is that you know you'll see that there are certain things that are handed off, and yeah, a new guy coming in might say, "Look, I'm going to do things a little differently." But quite frankly, again, you may have individuals like you know everybody thinks of Eisenhower as this you know stalwart, perfectly strategic president and all that stuff. But quite frankly, I mean, he's a military guy coming into civilian command. There's a bunch of things that somebody might have handed off to him, and he might go, well, I don't really know about this. Maybe I should just let it run its course. But I find it interesting that people think that all of it is handed off president to president. That's not true. but I just wanted to run it by you and see what you thought about that regarding this evolution, because there are a great many different politicians and, in fact, secretaries of state that come into office during this time period. And, you know, there is some coherence to what's happening here. So I'm imagining somewhere there was, you know, bureaucratic stability that allowed this period of experimentation again to continue. I you know, again, I'm making a supposition here, but I wanted to run it by you and see what you thought or what you found regarding that.
Yeah, yeah, no, I think it was the one where, the show that I did with Mike, The Past American Century, where we discussed who's actually in charge of clandestine operations, which unfortunately the answer is no one.
Yeah.
But, because it's so diffused, because there really is ultimately no final authority you can lay the blame on.
Right.
So in this case, yeah, no, I agree with you that it does – there are definitely certain policies that get handed off that we can obviously see. And then there are, you know, less spoken ideas I'm sure that they know wouldn't be popular publicly, but they still have to discuss them.
Right, right. And no, it's just something I want people to recognize the nuances here that it's not – you know, we have the peaceful transition of power, so to speak, but it doesn't necessarily mean that everything is translated – from one administration to the next perfectly.
No.
you know.
I'd say the current one and the last one would demonstrate that.
Well, yeah, I mean, look, that's the easiest example, but I'm just saying that, you know, well, actually it's kind of like, look, everything I was doing, here you go. Okay, I'm going to undo it. Thanks. Yeah. You know, that's where we're at today.
That's an option, too, that we see once in a while.
We do see that option, and sometimes people go, look, I'm going to do all these things, but that's got to go. You know, and people do that, you know. Again, Carter brings in Stansfield Turner for CIA. Yeah. That, to me, is one of the most hilarious time periods in history. Because Carter was like, yeah, I'm going to do this different, and they were kind of told him no. So that's...
I think, yeah, when Nixon brought in Schlesinger and, like, they fired 10%.
Yeah, right.
Of all the officers.
Mm-hmm. It's just, you know, sometimes you can do stuff, and...
We're getting flashes here. Hopefully it's not going to... get worse, just so you know.
Oh, yeah. Well, look, that could occur here, too, so you never know. But actually, I know that the big storm is not going to hit until at least during the weekend, no matter what speed it does or whose model you believe. So hopefully we'll stay online here, and I'll shut up now.
But, well, no, hey, what are you going to do? I'd rather we be having a good conversation if it does happen.
No, I know. And listen, we could always record later if something went terribly, terribly wrong, but I'd rather get through it if we can. So
yeah.
Anyways, okay. No, I just want to enter those thoughts into the equation, because a lot of people might be sitting here trying to picture this and listen and say to themselves, well, you know, what of the passing of the baton, so to speak? What of the, you know, the continuity of government, right? On some levels, it is very direct. There is a continuity there that is built in by the momentum of the bureaucracy. On, you know, even things that are not necessarily critical or nefarious or secretive, there's a lot of continuity that's built in, and it does pass rather easily from one administration to the next, but not everything. And when it comes to this intelligence stuff, you got a grab bag here. You never know. Depending on each circumstance you examine, you'll find that the, you know, the next five presidents are just fine with what it is you were doing, or no. You know, sometimes there's a mistranslation, misunderstanding. They create a redundancy. You don't even know what's going on sometimes. It's very confusing. But there are a variety of things that happen when it comes to the continuity of these sorts of things. So, again, I think it's a remarkable time period in that a lot of experimentation takes place under various people that are in leadership, you know, as the front of the operation, you know what I mean? There are a varying difference between the presidents. There's a big, huge difference between the secretaries of state, and yet this time period continues on almost as if, you know, it's one guy's plan at a certain point to, again, allow for experimentation. So, okay, go ahead.
No, I agree with you. And we can see, I think, that all the way extending into our own time, where we see that, and it's not so big of a swing if you look at it in context of history, as, you know, where let's just say the last three presidents between George W. Bush, Barack Obama, and Donald Trump. If you go back and you look at the swing between Roosevelt to Truman, Truman to Eisenhower, Eisenhower to Kennedy, Kennedy mm-hmm. to Johnson, Johnson to Nixon. I mean, that is almost a complete swing of the pendulum through the center all the way to the edges.
Right. No, absolutely. That is quite a swing there, but yet all these things continue to evolve, thrive. You know what I'm saying? So,
yeah.
And again, the time period we're delving into is still open. Remember what was going on with the FBI at this time, right? So you have a lot of interesting stuff still, by the way, with the prevailing anarchists being the great boogeyman, one way or another, whether it's legitimate or not in the country is another discussion, but... you know, this is the big threat, right? That and whatever it is that is supposed to be learned post-World War I, which I argue wasn't very much, but nonetheless, this is the time period in which this the ingredients come together to be baked into what we're going to hear next. So
yeah, I'd say World War I is sort of like the, you know, in just, you know, this isn't, of course, totally definitive of the age, but I think post-World War I is sort of like the death of monarchy.
Right.
And then once we get into World War II, fascism rears its head to take the place of anarchism or anything else that they're afraid of.
Well, right, and then it's quickly turned over after the war to communism. So there you go. Okay, go ahead.
So when the plan to stop the COI and the formation of the OSS failed, Strong had Brigadier General Hayes Croner create a, quote, perpetual, far-seeing, far-distant, continuing secret intelligence service. In other words, quote, Croner was to establish a long-term, albeit secret, rival to Donovan's agency. Mm-hmm. That's actually in the record.
Oh, wait, that's like a direct thing from the record?
Yes.
I thought that was you asserting that.
No. This is from the CIA report discussing it.
Wow, okay.
So Strong wanted a group specifically to oppose the OSS.
Nice. Okay. At least there's clarity there. Go ahead.
Indeed, the very ego of General Strong and his supporters and subordinates were focused to create a contrary group to the OSS mission with the advantage of greater secrecy. Croner would be given orders to establish this organization, quote, under the highest secrecy and create a static hierarchy that would endure until it was dissolved. He likely selected John V. Grombeck to lead this concealed new intelligence agency because of Grombeck's qualifications, similar distaste for Donovan's OSS, and his rare insider's view of some operations the COI undertook. Mm. It was born from the anger and the jealousy Strong expressed to oppose the OSS, constituted by Croner, and Grombeck was to lead the new group. Grombeck's executive officer, Charles Stevenson, constructed a plan in the winter of 1943 to advocate for the perpetual existence of the pond. It suggested closely monitoring future German and Japanese ambitions regarding world conquest, and the system was created to prevent other nations from seeking, quote, world domination. Notably, he doesn't talk about our plans.
Well, because, you know, the expanse of our empire is not part of their issue, right? Supposedly.
Yeah, that's a good thing.
That should be right. We see later that doesn't survive. But, go ahead.
The plans, of course, do not mention the most likely target, which was not Japan or Germany, but the Soviets. Mm. We should consider the political ideology of the PON's leadership and sponsors about the largest communist association on Earth. The PON's leaders were helping to mold the visage of America's post-war enemy for decades, and such ideas would proliferate until the end of the Soviet Union. Russia and the Soviet Union can be a very attractive option for those seeking to link public officials with enemy nations to discredit them. The group would use the, quote, real cover of the U.S. military's coverage and indoctrination branch, to which Grombeck already was assigned, and the group's leader divided his time between outside work and the secret group's offices in New York City. By the end of the war, that office transformed into Special Service Branch. And following the end of combat, Grombeck would further create the Universal Service Corporation. But many officials were not clear about the extent this business might have served as a further cover mechanism. Mm-hmm. So unlike the CIA, where they would use independent, you know, sometimes they would create corporations, but it wasn't usually one of their own people creating it. They would at least either get a false identity or somebody else to do it. Grombeck was actually creating companies.
Mm. So now that is a bit different from, say, the creation of trying to think of what is it that they created, the American Express Company at one point, right, to create payments. I believe it's the company that turns into like the American Express, you know, the credit card people.
Mm-hmm.
That corporation, if I remember correctly, starts out as kind of a CIA shell.
The one I always remember is Wackenhut, because of the name.
Well, Wackenhut that comes up recently, too. But go ahead.
Yeah, one of the dummy groups they created.
Yeah, and continues to exist, right? So, it's funny, though. I mean, but there are a bunch of corporations that are created to facilitate certain activities. But you're right. Usually they're not directly created by an officer of. It's not like Alan Dulles turns around and creates one of these companies. You know what I mean?
Yeah,
for the CIA.
Hires, Yeah, he wasn't hiring spies out of his law firm.
No, he wasn't. Right, Sullivan and Cromwell wasn't, you know, creating companies. I mean, it is kind of odd to have the guy do it himself. Usually, you know, this is another reason why they recruited business assets, though, because you know what? If you took a guy who was failing business wise but had great access in a foreign nation of interest, you know, look, how about we fund him? Right? You figure out a way to get him funded one way or another to, you know, establish a corporation which does have convenient assets one way or another, whether it's for shipping or it's for the movement of people or it's for, you know, some other campaign, like, you know, it's an advertising entity or it has an advertising arm and that is used for propaganda. There are various ways to integrate these things without them being directly tied to the intelligence agency. But in this case, the guy is establishing a corporation directly. That's interesting. Go ahead.
The vagary surrounding the pond, even for officials, was revealed when Croner himself later testified, quote, "When I left direction of that office in the beginning of 1944, only some in the War Department, State, the President's office, and the President himself knew it existed." Within a couple of years, the term "the pond" had caught on with those in the know. But the director of naval intelligence in that period, concerned with most officials, concurred with most officials that the Army never told them about the pond. And another ranking naval intelligence officer stated, quote, "We found out about it only by accident and against the wishes of the Army. They never offered the Navy the services. They never offered to make them available to meet our needs. Not a single bit of information that was obtained by the Army agency ever came to the Navy."
Well, but here you go. It's not like the, you know, the Army intelligence and naval intelligence people haven't done that before.
Yeah.
They are.
That's the enduring habit with all of them. They don't want to share.
Yeah, they don't share. See, that's the thing is even if you go to, what is the most convenient excuse with 9/11, right? Is that, and I do say excuse, is that, the intelligence agencies weren't sharing information with each other. If they had, we could have developed the right picture. I'm not saying I buy that, but if you do buy that, it is a logical thing to say, well, why is there not, and therefore, you know. Again, this is why I thought the Central Intelligence Agency was born, but my mistake.
Well, yeah. We've only been dealing with this since Pearl Harbor.
Yeah, yeah. I thought, you know, and there were various investigations there which basically pointed to the same thing, which is, well, if this intelligence agency had shared this, and if this, well, okay, fine. And nowadays, you know, you have fusion centers and you have the cooperative umbrellas under which different agencies are supposed to cooperate. And, it's tangled web.
Yeah. Well, the question I think ultimately that we should be asking our officials is, how big of an infrastructure do you require to be competent?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that is an extremely valid question. Mm-hmm.
Because if they can't do it with the one we have already, then we need to downsize and hire some new people.
Yeah, definitely. Because, again, 16 agencies that we know of. I mean, that's a bit. That's a bit more than most places, you know. Imagine we're getting to MI-16 in Britain.
Well, yeah.
And
do we have, you know, what is the name of the current version of the pond? Because I wouldn't be surprised if there was one.
Oh, no. You see, that's the interesting thing here, too, is that I guarantee you that there are certain subgroups and subsets that exist right now where there's more of a cozy relationship between, say, like, oh, I don't know, the Department of Homeland Security and, let's use another agency which we haven't touched on, but I did earlier, the ATF, right?
Yeah.
So if you put the ATF would logically have a more cozy relationship with Homeland Security because of the firearms and also because it's not in their letters there, but they also cover explosives. So it would make sense that Homeland Security would get information from the ATF, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
Okay. So, you know what I mean? It's like, and the FBI and Homeland Security, they would have to be hand in glove. But it's weird because I guarantee you that there's much more chummy subsets, regardless of the cooperation that's supposed to exist now. And there's still territoriality is prevailing in some places. I can almost guarantee it. I mean,
You're right. No, we don't even have to. That's just a human pattern. There's people that want to secure their turf.
Right, right. So go ahead. As we get toward the last 10 minutes or so here, I want to kind of give a logical stop point for the first hour.
Okay. It seems not only was Grombeck trying to oppose the OSS, but additionally, he would not allow the centralization of intelligence collection even within the military. Was it Grombeck's influence or Strong's orders that prevented OSS from operating in all the theaters of battle in World War II? In fact, while Donovan was battling for regular operations and resources with departments, the Pond made a secret arrangement with the State Department to attain official cover for its agents and made deals with companies similar to later CIA arrangements. The Dutch multinational Philips Corporation offered to help the OSS and Army G2, and thus the Pond as well. The company was among those funding some Pond operations and providing commercial cover to its agents. However, General Strong learned of the OSS assistance, and following a strongly worded message to Donovan, the OSS relented and severed all ties with Phillips, and this left G2 and consequently Grombeck the lone beneficiary of this corporate assistance.
Mm-hmm. So there you go. And again, you know, the agency's being established with the idea officially in the record to do precisely this, kind of not a shock, is it?
No. I was just surprised, though, that he did it so directly. That Strong just basically wrote Donovan a letter and said, pull out.
Yeah. But that's the thing is, and here's the thing about official records, by the way. It's remarkable to read what it is they will include sometimes. But you do know always that it's not the full story that's retained in the official records ever.
Yeah. Yeah, there's subtext.
There's always subtext there. So, the fact that he was being told to pull out, this could be for a variety of reasons that are not necessarily delineated in the letter. Okay. But it could be that, that there was some other thing that's off books here before that where it's like, listen, I'm going to tell you a few things and you're not going to like them. There could have been conversation, like not every phone call is ever recorded either. And there were phone calls that, we may have records that phone calls exist, but we don't necessarily know the contents of them. And from this time period, forget it, So, communications are not being entire. I'm just saying that I guarantee you there's more to it, but the fact that a stark memorialization like that is there is pretty interesting, because normally it would be we recommend, we suggest that this may be the more efficient route of conduct for said agency, but no, this is just direct.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah. Well, I think after they were being so obvious about just the creation of the Pond, that Strong wasn't going to be delicate.
Why bother with nuance? Okay, fair enough. Go ahead.
And I think it's interesting, like you were mentioning earlier, which is funny because you had no idea I was going to bring it up, but here's every intelligence group needs a good multinational corporation.
Yep. Don't they all? And again, you see this, as soon as you said, like CIA's arrangements, what do I think of immediately? International Fruit Company, the people that became Dole, the sugar companies, the stuff in South America and
Raytheon and
who else? I'm sorry.
I said Raytheon.
Raytheon, yeah. it gets bigger and bigger as you go, but it's just fascinating to me that no matter what time period you talk about, it's like I can see exactly where the corporate interests are part of the equation.
And, Well, and how funny is it that people talk about, you know, like the modern take on it is that, you know, you want to support corporations that are act morally or do good things. Well, how far back are we willing to look at their sins? Because if you go far back enough, anybody shaving with an Orelco razor helped assassins.
Yeah, right.
I mean, if that's the game we're playing.
No, right. And look, if you've had sugar in your coffee, I mean, there's probably a genocide in there somewhere.
Yeah.
I'm not kidding either, by the way. Entire groups of people were wiped out over sugar plantations.
Yeah. Don't drive your car anymore, because gasoline comes from oil and oil comes from murder.
Yeah, that too. So, you know, I'm just saying, you know, when you come to there's blatant realities of it, but after a while, yeah, historically, if you take a look at these things, it is not a matter of moral or patriotic duty. That's another thing that's always brought up. It's like, well, you know, if a corporation is going to do its patriotic duty because it's American, you know, or it's multinational, but it has its, you know, allegiances tied to American interests or whatever delusional sort of, you know, deluded a concept they put forward for justifying it, it's not about that. It's just like with the criminal agencies, not the criminal agencies, excuse me, the agencies working with criminal organizations, which, again, no surprise that I slipped it into one thing, because it's about opportunity and what is useful. I guarantee you that, you know, CIA people were not in love with the La Cosa Nostra guys. It's not like they thought these are great people. They're patriotic Americans. Now, some of them were, but that is not the reason.
There were a couple dumb CIA people who did believe that line, but
no. I allow for the idiocy at all times, but the fact is, it's got nothing to do with anything. It's got to do with this: the criminal organizations are doing it because, first of all, they can get some more business, and it's advantageous to them, and it's advantageous to the agency.
Yeah.
So that's why those relationships exist. But on top of it, it's also like the idea, and a lot of them thought this. You can read in their own, you know, memoirs. You can hear in their own testimony. You can see in their own records. A lot of them thought that since they were working with the American government, that this would provide them with some level of protection. And in some cases, it did.
Yep. Giancana.
Giancana, but in some cases it did not.
Okay.
There you go. You know, so this is the problem, right? You can't just say, well, you know, the CIA just loved those Italians, and the CIA loved those, you know, whoever else it is they worked with criminal organizations-wise. The CIA loved Nazis. The CIA loved – no, they didn't have a love for anybody. It was about who they could use for what. Who provided them with the resources or access they needed, period. And it works the other way around, okay? And the thing is this, business is business. Whether it's a legitimate on-paper corporation or it's, you know, the five families, it's irrelevant. The businesses are doing business with these agencies because guess what? It's advantageous to them. Okay. I mean, do you think I'm being unfair here at all, Carmine?
No. There's, of course, specific instances where it's not always going to be that. But most of the time, 95% of the time, yes. They're doing it. They're doing it for the same reasons that we all do self-interested activities.
Right.
You know, these are things that expand our influence, increase our power, increase our status. Of course. That's, you know, I mean, I'm not saying that any of it can be justified morally. But at the end of the day, not as many people as you would think are concerned with being morally justifiable and are more concerned with surviving, are more concerned with having more money, with giving their family more things, and they don't care the whatever means they have to take to get there.
Yeah, advantage and leverage always seem to trump moral turpitude. Okay.
Look at the church. Look at any major religion. You know, morality goes for a long time until it affects their interests, and then morality changes.
Yeah, well, then, you know, you should turn in most people to the police, but not our people, because, yeah, right, I got you. No, definitely all the way around, and I think that is a good stopping point, because it is a good thing to remember when we're taking a look at these interesting interactions between the public-private sector and the secret sector, if you will, of things in general. So anyway, Carmine's with me tonight, and we are going through yet again another interesting discussion about a little-known agency. This one you can file under the pond, and I don't know, I have this feeling that pond scum is going to have to be in the SEO title for tonight's show, but we'll see what it looks like when we get there. Meanwhile, stick around. The Ocelli Effect with Carmine Savastano will be right back.
WallStreetWindow.com. Gold, silver, the stock market. WallStreetWindow.com. The brilliant author of The War State brings you exclusive reports about the big changes upcoming in the markets. WallStreetWindow.com.
Perhaps you're invested deeply.
Perhaps you're not in deep enough. Maybe you're thinking about getting started. WallStreetWindow.com. Michael Swanson, the brilliant author of The War State, understood these trends professionally for many years, and now he gives you the benefit of his knowledge. WallStreetWindow.com. Go there now. Go there now. Go there now.
News, entertainment, and more. You will learn something, children's. Ocelli.com.
Go ahead, caller.
Yeah, I'm interested in the truth about the JFK assassination.
Right. Well, what do you want to know?
Judy Baker's wild claim, Oswald girlfriend, she knew Ruby and Barry, cancer weapons. Really?
I imagine I could claim I have four wheels. It doesn't make me a wagon, but okay.
Oswald was on the kill team and trying to prevent the murder of John Kennedy. Come on now. Has a real expert on the JFK assassination looked into her claims?
Go to Amazon.com. Enter Judith Baker in her own words. You'll get results for a digital copy of a book where Walt Brown utilizes her own words and the known evidence in the case to get at, well, a different perspective, let's say. You can get Judith Barry Baker in her own words from the author himself, signed if you request it, by contacting Dr. Brown at KIASJFK@AOL.com. It's a fun book, and it actually dissects the many, many fantastic claims. Judith Barry Baker in her own words.
Thank you for all the great information.
What I do? Revelation through conversation. In a radio show / podcast. You want the good news? Listen to the Ocelli Effect. Chuck Ocelli is the most underrated voice in all media. News, education, and entertainment. The Daily Bread from Ocelli.com. Go there. Save yourself from ignorance. Ocelli.com. But we all agreed to put Ocelli.com on and listen to The Ocelli Effect. Revelation through conversation. Ocelli.com.
Where in the world is
Carmine Salvestano?
We should learn from our relatively recent history, my brother. That's where I'm coming from. I say our power to the people.
And now, the most underrated voice in all media.
Ocelli. Second hour of the Ocelli Effect begins now at Ocelli.com. Do appreciate you for tuning in. No matter who you are, where you are, I'm sure most of you are catching this via podcast. We do have kind of a light stream night tonight. I see that, but I also note that there are people listening in Washington and Texas and, let's see, where else? California. Nobody listening in Florida. You're probably busy. Okay, and I understand. Maybe you'll catch this later. Anyways, Maryland, unknown U.S. people. Okay, great. So, it is what it is.
Nice. Maryland.
Yeah.
Camp Peary isolation facility.
Sure. Well, you know, they had some of those facilities took a bit of a hit recently, so I don't know. Sure. Welcome to our listeners with the NSA and whoever else, whatever other government agency is listening in. Do appreciate you as well. And, you know, hopefully you're learning a little bit about yourselves. How about that?
Screaming. I'm trying to hear what they're saying.
Oh, that's hilarious. Anyway, Carmine Salvestano is with me. The author of Two Princes and a King. And, you know, you can always go and, check out his website too. He appreciates the traffic, even if it is masked. So there you go. It's a lot of fun. Now I do advise you guys to go get his book at some point. You know, I don't bring that up often enough when I have you on that, you still have your book out there. You're working on other projects and maybe even going to update Two Princes and a King at some point soon, right?
Yeah, we're shooting for the end of the year to have out the new book, and then, yeah, I'm going to be doing an update in the future.
There you go.
I'd like to add some more of the new files, because at 2016, they hadn't come out yet, so I want to add some of the files, the very newest files.
Exactly, and that's a good idea. Also, just really quickly, because we are down to the last couple of days here where I'm going to accept this, I still have some of those ink drawings left, and a bunch of them are unclaimed, so... the offer still stands up until September 1st. If you make a donation to $10, I will be more than happy to send you at least three of these things. And it's that simple. Larger donations get larger amounts. It's that simple too. I've also added a few things to people's packages. I've already started sending them out, even though I said I was going to send them out on the 1st. I wanted to get them out of the way. So, that there wouldn't be like some sort of last minute. I mean, I'm expecting a big last minute crash for my drawings, right? No, but it's just a unique and personalized way to say thank you. They are one of a kind, all that kind of stuff. And, so it is what it is. Hopefully, you guys are still willing to do that. And again, you can make a donation at Ocelli.com and simply send me a mailing address and you will receive those. Now there could be a minor delay. In fact, if you get in on these last couple of days because of the storms and if they close the post office or slow down mail, things like that could occur, but I promise you I will put them out in the mail as soon as I can and all that good stuff. Let's see, a couple of interesting things do remain, like the image of Susan Oliver and a bunch of other just artistic musings of mine. A couple of people that are on the show. Carmine's is gone, but let's see, regular Joe, Maria Heller is still in there. Oh, no, wait, Maria Heller's already gone. My mistake. There's a few people that are left or whatever, so you can also give me a preference in your message and tell me that, you know, you would prefer not to get my What did I call that? Female form stuff, or you could say I'd rather see the political or not the political, or I'd rather see esoteric stuff because there's esoteric stuff in there. I also have some kind of horror images that I've kind of put together as well. It's just a bunch of different sketches, my style, and hopefully, you know, people won't be too angry at them when they make their donations and get them in return. But again, it's just a thank you. So there you go. All right, now that I've taken up a whole 2 extra minutes of your time, Carmine, I'm sorry.
That's fine.
You know, I wanted to get that out there because it might be the last chance.
Yeah.
Anyway, we are focused on the pond. And, you know, for this hour, for the rest of this hour, I mean, again, I'm just going to sort of hang back and take a listen to the rest of what you have because I'd like you to get all the way through it tonight if we could. Most nights I don't allow Carmine to get all the way through in case anybody doesn't know that. And references will be provided with the podcast. So you can go take a look at what it is Carmine is reading from, where he got his information from, and by all means, continue to explore. I love it when I get messages from you guys and you tell me, hey, look, you know what, I discovered something new, or hey, I'd never realized this is interesting material one way or another. That's what we're here for. And Thursdays usually with Carmine are very educational. We try and have a little fun with it, but you do learn a lot of history and a lot of very particular things. And I think over the years, actually, you know, we probably provided a master class when it comes to examining the behavior of government agencies and controversial issues and things like that one way or another, through Sinister History, JFK 101, now 201, the Myths episodes, which, by the way, I am definitely planning on doing a Myths episode very soon, and it might be a lot of fun considering the things I'm hearing. Anyway, all that in the very near future. Carmine, I turn it back over to you regarding the pond. We were discussing, you know, how these agencies kind of interact and how there are various differences and seeming continuity that is not always really continuity. Sometimes it's bureaucratic. We've talked about the competition between different agencies, and there's a good reason for it as you go forward. So please continue, sir.
Okay. So we had just discussed a little bit about the alliance that was solely between the Phillips Corporation and G2, which meant the pond. This alliance offered the pond international reach by using its corporate supporters for access that was normally untenable in areas such as enemy nations. However, what we also have to remember is that Grombeck was extremely paranoid about other people handling any part of the intelligence structure that he had built. So one example where his instincts were actually correct was when the pond relied on a system that included using British couriers delivering information to them from Europe. And Grombeck began to suspect, and what the CIA notes in the later history was, they don't know how he figured it out, but he suspected that they were, and it could have just been, you know, his instinct that of course he'd do it, so they're doing it, that somebody was reading the gathered intelligence in spite of international conventions protecting these diplomatic pouches.
Right. See, here's the thing about the word paranoid or paranoia when it comes up in these discussions. A lot of people think that's a negative word. Not always. Sometimes paranoia in this business that you're talking about here, rather healthy and correct. It's not really paranoia, I don't think, even when they're actually after you or you're correct. But to have sort of a paranoid attitude regarding these things, almost necessary, really. And the idea that that has to prevail is, if I were in my opponent's position and had the resources that they have, what would I do? I mean, listen, this is, you know, Sun Tzu. What are you going to do? You got to know your enemy, okay? Yeah. And you got to know that you got multiple enemies, and you got to know their capabilities and never underestimate them, because otherwise you lose. You know, and this is a very dicey business. So, you know, when we talk about Angleton and his, like, evolving paranoia, yeah, that becomes a negative. But on some levels...
He wasn't wrong earlier on.
That's kind of the blessing and the curse of it at the same time. Because, you know, once you are so right, you can now have a difficulty not seeing when you're wrong, too. But either way, paranoia is not necessarily a negative, in the business we're talking about here, right?
Yeah, no, it's not. And this, you know, this is one example of when Grombach could be right, mm-hmm. when he was paranoid.
Yeah.
And, so yeah, under the Geneva Convention, there are certain diplomatic established rules. And one of them is the protection of pouches that are used diplomatically between nations so that they can have secure information passed between their embassies.
Right.
Now, another thing I think that we can add to what Chuck just said is that not only do we have to worry about our enemy countries, we have to worry about our allies.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody wants to know what's in those pouches. It's a human thing, once again.
Well, yeah, and
everyone
again,
wants to know secrets.
Right, and again, I pointed out many times on this show, with you and without you, how many allegedly allied nations have been involved in the most aggressive programs of spying against America. The Israeli spy programs are legendary.
Yeah, and Israel, France, UK.
The French have done it, the UK. Everybody has attempted to do this.
Yeah.
But it's not always necessarily your enemies. I guarantee you that if you dig deep enough, we have Canadian spies who have... Yeah.
And I bet they're the nicest spies in the world.
I bet you they are, too. But, I mean, I guarantee you there are Canadian spies that do infiltrate certain organizations, certain agencies, that get information, get their hands on it when they're not really supposed to. You know, I believe any nation who is not participating. See, that's the thing. A lot of people say, well, all the spying just needs to stop. Well, problem is that
it won't.
You're in dereliction of duty if you're not at this point in time.
Yeah, it won't stop. I mean, that's just. You have to trust all the other nations to do it, and good luck with that. That's how we got into the hole in intelligence to begin with.
Yeah, right. So, you know, not a good idea. Now, does the assumption that the enemy is doing something simply because they can sometimes grow and fester into something out of control? Oh, yes.
Yeah.
But it is irresponsible, negligent, beyond, like, criminally negligent, in my estimation, to assume that your friends or your enemies are not willing to spy on, seek advantage, seek leverage, just simply gather information, because that is what we all are doing. And it doesn't matter what language, what alliances, it's irrelevant. It's happening all the time. So that's just something to consider. Please continue, Carmine.
Well, and I just wanted to add, I think it was a handicap. I think that was an American handicap that we caught from the British, from, you know, the British sensibilities, and I'm sure the British paid for it earlier in history for not having developed so extensive of a clandestine service.
Yeah, well, it's just like, you know, tactically, you know, the gentleman's war, if you will. No. This is not,
no.
If you want to fight a gentleman's war, if the other guy's fighting a gentleman's war, that's great, but, you know... But when guys start hiding behind trees and firing their muskets at you, it doesn't work so well.
Yeah.
You know,
snipers aren't gentlemen.
No, they're not. Very good. Go ahead.
So, when Grombach grew suspicious, he arranged to have an unopened pouch intercepted and sent to the FBI for testing. It was revealed that they had been expertly opened and resealed. No doubt with his existing distaste for all things OSS, paired with the rival group's heavy reliance on British intelligence, this caused Grombeck to assign only Americans to deliver future pouches for the entire pond. Mm. Which I can kind of respect as far as a across-the-board move.
Well, it is a default that if you have evidence that shows you now have an issue, well, you know, how is it that we could reasonably begin to eliminate a significant significant risk? Well, you know, what do? You don't, even when you are in an alliance, you don't share everything with your allies either. See, that's another aspect to that game we were just talking about, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
So, quite frankly, again, pragmatically, paranoia-wise, correct.
Go ahead. Yeah, and you can see it on a smaller scale, as you mentioned before, with our own agencies. They do the same thing.
Oh,
groups
yeah.
that should be allied act counter to each other.
Yes, sometimes they absolutely do. And, you know, you have to not only assume that that is the circumstance, but build it into your model for behavior. Because you need to be prepared. So, go ahead.
Somebody wants pineapples on the pizza.
There it is. Go ahead.
So once he discovered that, this shows that while indeed the British were America's allies, they too were not above reading classified information or gathered intelligence their ally did not wish discovered. Similar to the OSS, the pond was largely reliant on using nearly any source it found reliable or valuable during World War II. And like the OSS, several mistakes were made by the use of compromised and deranged agents. However, unlike Donovan, who faced external scrutiny and the departmental interference, Grombeck's agency had a deal and was off the books and compartmentalized from most people in power. While certainly the OSS had several reprehensible enemy sources, and even some agents, at least one source of intelligence for the pond feasibly might outclass many in terms of pure evil.
Mm. Really quickly, I want to bring something up because I just got a Skype message, and it is from Kevin, who is normally in Florida, but is apparently relocated to, where are you saying? I guess that's Alabama is what you mean to tell me. You're in Alabama now, and you're listening, so that's why I don't see you in Florida on the stream. Okay, but he wanted to bring up a point here that that sometimes this would also be a mechanism by which instead of feeding the instead of looking at the information that they might have gathered from the pouches, the agency, the pond, could have had the option to put misinformation in the pouches to misdirect whoever was reading them, and in code. Okay, I think I understand what he's saying. And yeah, I think that's a factor too, is that there's a couple of different ways this could have been played out, where, you know, it could have been useful to misdirect the British, that were opening up the pouches and therefore misdirect the OSS.
Well, it's possible, but I think they were already working on other. They had enough to deal with.
No, maybe so.
It's easier to cork it and move it along.
No, I got you, but I mean, it's not outside of the realm of it's not just in the realm of imagination that might have happened, and it's not a crazy thought that somebody could say, "Well, let's misdirect them intentionally." You know, either in order to, you know, get somebody to tip their hand, you might be able to actually trace the network if you find out,
Well, I would say that's more CIA style. That's not Pond style. Grombeck
didn't
operate like that. Grombeck operated by, as you'll see, more like Hoover.
No, fair enough. But yeah. I'm just saying that, but see, it wasn't beyond Hoover to put out disinformation either. And feed it to certain people, right? So it's common practice to have gone
possible,
in that direction.
It's possible, but it's probably not standard operating procedure for Grombeck. And in this case, I don't think it really applies. It's not necessary. It's an added complexity that is unrequired.
Okay, fair enough. But I'm saying that it is a possibility.
Well, anything's possible, sure.
Yeah, when you encounter a circumstance like this, though, it's not like that hasn't been done, where they turned around and intentionally.
You have to worry about counterintelligence.
Right.
So
and then,
you know, how much are you going to invest into just how about just use Americans?
Right. I got you. No, and I get it. That is the pragmatic solution, which probably shortened up the workload by quite a bit. Because, you know, you got to encode these things and then make sure that your people are not taking the disinformation the wrong way. And,
yeah.
You know, it
ends up in your people's hands. What if one of their sources then gives it to one of your sources?
Yeah, right. So, you know, now you have to prevaricate against your own disinformation, which it's not like these things haven't happened. But in this case, not really likely. Go ahead.
Okay. So as I was saying, what was it? So while the OSS had its fair share of reprehensible enemy sources, the PON had one that might outclass all of them. Marcel Pieto, I want to say it correctly, Marcel Pieto was a Frenchman that Pryor was deemed mentally unfit to stand trial for committing fraud. Mm. Despite this, he later served in the French army amid World War I, and faced trial again for stealing army blankets, yet was a second time deemed psychologically unfit for punishment.
Mm-hmm.
And that is just a weird thing to do, to start stealing army blankets. I mean, I suppose they're a rarity, but how are you not going to get caught? I mean, aren't the other guys in the army going to notice that you're stealing their blankets?
The circumstances, sometimes when you dig deep enough, they start to make sense, but on the surface, it's just kind of a comical thing. Like, why would you steal army blankets anyway?
Yeah, I mean, I could see they're a rarity, but it's who's not going to notice when their blanket's gone?
Well, I don't know. You know, maybe he could have been taking them off of dead soldiers.
Yeah, that's true, I guess. Yeah, maybe you're stockpiling them and selling them like that.
Yeah, I mean, that's the kind of thing I know was done with other things like boots, when, you know, guys got fresh boots and stuff like that. And then they got killed on the front line. Sometimes if those were salvageable, they were taken right off the corpses, you know, no problem. You know, stuff like that did happen in various places.
And that was a common practice in medieval times. I mean, there were people that actually waited at the site of battles for everything to end so they could go on and pick everyone clean.
Yeah, right. So, I mean, you know, again, I don't know the whole circumstances there, but it is kind of strange that the guy gets caught and then for the second time is deemed, unworthy of punishment based on his mental condition. But, you know, not like we can't find other examples of intelligence agencies using people that are not
mentally
necessarily not necessarily mentally fit for service for various purposes. So go ahead.
Mentally, psychologically insane and still used. And I think it's funny, too, that they always seem to be able to get into the military, too.
Oh, yeah. Well, I'll leave that to the listener's imagination. Go ahead.
So he was sent back to service, and following a reported mental collapse, he was removed from service again displayed increasingly erratic actions and conduct, but he later attended a school and obtained a medical degree.
Wow.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
This doctor that was prior deemed unfit to stand trial for mental deficiency then opened an office in France and rose to a position of respect that eventually allowed him to become the town's mayor.
See, the Marquis de Saint-Germain.
Go ahead. The Marquis de Chardin.
Wow.
So the town, he is finally, and this is while he's mayor, he faces a third charge of fraud and finally is convicted.
Okay, because as a doctor and a mayor, he's okay now.
Well, apparently.
Okay, just checking. Yeah.
In time, he's very eccentric. In time, the death of some of his patients under strange circumstances began to attract notice, including one that suggested Pieto was responsible for the deaths, and this attracted greater attention, forcing him to relocate to Paris. As World War II raged, Pieto decided upon a plot to lure Jewish immigrants escaping the Nazis by offering them shelter and aid, and said he would provide them a new life outside of German-held France. Following the soundproofing of his residence that contained a large basement furnace, Pieto was assured of no interference from an outside passerby and the means to dispose of evidence. For in reality, this helpful doctor was a serial killer that desired to acquire the wealth of those he assisted, and the health shots he gave entire families was actually cyanide that brought on a horrible death. Wow. The killer would repeatedly watch his victims die, and following these inhuman murders, Pietro would ransack their valuables.
Wow. Okay. And remind me again what this guy was useful for?
He told the Pond intelligence on what was going on with some of the local Nazis.
Well, on the one hand, one could say...
He also did work with the, it's crazy, because he did work with the French Resistance, too, in some a couple of times.
Wow. I mean, there's just... There's a lot to this guy.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
I was not aware of the serial killer in the mix here tonight, I want to tell you. So, okay. So, and objectively, right, simply because he is a deranged serial killer and because he has been mentally incompetent at various times, does not necessarily mean that he doesn't have some unique intelligence. And just by the fact that he continues to survive and have careers and... Because, I mean, that's kind of remarkable, kind of interesting. This is definitely a eccentric personality. Yeah, you said it already, but...
Yeah, in retrospect, a medical degree makes perfect sense.
Yeah, it does. Wow. Okay. Please continue, Carmine.
Normally when you come across a figure like this, of course, we're all going to be like, oh, my God. But it's amazing to me how this guy was able to somehow navigate through these areas that should have never let him enter.
Like, I'm actually impressed by this guy. I mean, I almost wonder if he's more than one guy. Because it seems so...
Or maybe he was putting it on. Maybe he was putting on the mental deficiency. He really was just play acting.
See, there you go. I mean, if you got a that is a likely scenario for a sociopathic individual, right? Who is just sitting there like, what can I gain by what can I gain? And he graduated from stealing blankets to stealing people's estates because he had access to their veins and trust. I mean, that's actually kind of likely.
I mean, that is. Pretty the bottom of reprehensible. Yeah, that's, you've pretty much hit ground level.
I mean, yeah, I mean, you go from petty thief, though, to rather sophisticated serial killer. One does also wonder if there might not be a trail of other bodies there. And again, you can throw people off. Listen, I'm just an idiot and I'm out of my mind. You know, I can't harm anybody. I steal blankets. Maybe there's an untold trail of bodies here.
Yeah, the war. How many people died in the war, quote-unquote?
Right. Well, that's why I mentioned the whole thing about soldiers, because I know quite often their corpses were stripped clean, their valuables were taken, you know, stuff like that. That happened a lot. So, you know, it could be that he was doing that and just happened to be caught taking the blankets, you know. Maybe he didn't get caught fencing the other stuff or whatever. I mean, there's just a lot to deal with this guy.
Yeah, he could have been smothering someone, and they're like, what are you doing? I want the blanket.
Yeah, right. Okay, and he's got a bunch of the blankets, which he kept as souvenirs, but nobody knew it, and maybe he sold. I don't know. I'm just saying that there's a lot going on here, and that's a rather interesting character right there in history. But and he may have indeed had something valuable to offer regarding, you know, certain things, you know, that... Wow. Okay. I'm a little stunned. Good one, though. Go ahead.
Ironically, during 1943, the Gestapo arrested him for aiding Jews.
Wow.
And associating with the French Resistance.
See, this is why it sounds to me like a sociopath, because there is no coherent kind of ethos to this behavior. Except that he's probably caught in compromised situations where he was seeking enrichment and advantage, and that's what a sociopath does, and they don't care if they got to kill somebody or do deviant things, and they play act in a lot of different ways, and as play actors, they're able to infiltrate certain circumstances, So that's why I said that, by the way. I have no evidence to prove that. I'm just saying that that's my impression from what it is you're telling me. Go ahead.
Surprisingly, to me, the irony of that whole situation is crazy. I mean, the Gestapo arrests the serial killer who's killing Jewish people because he thinks he's helping them.
Yeah. But again, because that's so convoluted.
Yeah.
it just seems to me like a sociopath who keeps slipping the traps. You know what I mean? Just whatever way I got to flip this, I'm going to flip this.
So,
and, yeah.
Well, I suppose playing into that possibility. So they had to release him eventually due to lacking evidence.
Right.
And the killer continued his spree another year. So elsewhere, despite the alliance between the U.S. and Russia against the Axis powers, Grombach still pursued stringent anti-communist policies by targeting the OSS and intelligence methods that he considered suspicious. This would eventually lead Grombach to undertake Project 1641, a study of communist subversion in the United States. Lists of suspects were drawn up with Grombach's reasoning for each name's inclusion, and unsurprisingly, at least a few of those named were Grombach's political or government competitors.
No kidding.
Well, fancy that.
Okay, no, go ahead. I blurted out, no kidding. I didn't mean to. I was away from the mic, and I was like, no kidding. Oh, yeah, but yeah, that's exactly what I thought. Go on.
J. Edgar Hoover's ghost. So, while this does not mean that most of those suggested had to be innocent, and certainly some were not, it does support that Grombach's standards could easily be led astray by his militant anti-communism and personal interest. The PONS leader turned over these lists to the FBI, and they began investigations of those named. In this, we can see the beginnings of the future Red Scare, as secret groups collected information on citizens and officials, then deemed them communist sympathizers or subversive to discredit them without any trial. Grombach also reportedly leaked information a la Hoover to the U.S. Senate, and that fed what years later would become the official Red Scare. This anti-communist fervor drove attacks on the CIA, Russian-born officials, pro-Soviet Roosevelt appointees, and OSS members.
Oh, yeah, that was like everybody, but it's when that had its run.
And it might be Grombach is the source of all of it.
Wow.
That he was feeding McCarthy and everybody else, Cohn, all of them.
That's a lot. Okay, go ahead.
When France was liberated, the local horrors occurring under the cover of greater Nazi atrocities were revealed, and over 24 corpses were found in Marcel Pietot's home. He was arrested, dubbed Dr. Satan by the press, admitted to over 60 murders, faced trial, and was guillotined in 1946, the same year the OSS was dissolved.
Okay.
Nevertheless, for Grombach, there was no chance for compromise with anyone with subversive beliefs. They were the enemy, and he would do everything possible to expose them, no matter what position in the U.S. government they held. During 1946, Strong and Grombach likely celebrated the dissolution of the OSS and followed up Donovan's fall with lists of G2 who transferred to the State Department that he suspected of being communists, and many were subordinates to a G2 competitor. His rival Alfred McCormack, the director of intelligence for G2, resigned following Grombach leaking that he suppressed a report about Soviet mass murder of Polish military officials following the end of diplomacy. While this could have been an attempt to save a prior wartime ally from bad press, Grombach had deemed it subversion, and it was a perfect time to do so for maximum effect. We can observe similar J. Edgar Hoover-like streak for tailoring information to his purposes while not overtly attacking his enemies in public. He essentially was poisoning the well. It did not matter if you're guilty if everyone believes you are, because often perception is mistaken for reality. With Donovan gone, Grombach settled in for smoother political waters, but the pond had little time to enjoy the success. Director of Central Intelligence Hoyt Vandenberg led the CIA's predecessor organization, the Central Intelligence Group, and during 1946, he attempted to fulfill the mandate of centralizing intelligence, which led to a proposal, of including the pond within the greater structure. Following a notable intelligence failure, Vandenberg criticized the pond's methods, agents, and stated he did not wish to associate them with CIG. Suddenly, Grombeck was faced with the possibility that his group might be disbanded. It was unnecessary or redundant, and in one diary entry, Grombeck claims that CIG, quote, was out to get me. Grombeck's suspicions were confirmed when a joint letter from exiting CIG Director Vandenberg and future CIA Director Roscoe Hillencoder suggested all G2 secret intelligence operations, quote, should be discontinued with the least practicable delay. This was likely a death sentence for the pond, or at least it would be divided up and reassigned, similar to OSS.
Right.
It seemed both of the ranking intelligence leaders supported its dissolution.
Okay.
The pond's leadership became so desperate it leaked its existence to the press to gather support and official recognition, something we see Dulles do in 53. The pond, too, considered if G2 was not allowed to dominate post-war intelligence, that it believed its allies in the State Department should. Yet Grombeck would lose the battle for dominating intelligence. CIG became CIA, and normally, similar to OSS, this would have been the end of the pond. Nevertheless, the pond was not your average intelligence group, and it lived on. The U.S. State Department gave the pond just enough legal funds to maintain its existence and prevent its dissolution or reassignment to CIA. Even with a limited amount of people aware of its role for the State Department, its role at the State Department was a problem because its budget was difficult to hide, and it caused problems for diplomatic efforts in some areas of operation. As 1950 arrived, Grombeck's organization was the subject of discontentment at the State Department. As the realities weighed on the State Department, the perceived domestic communist threats weighing on Grombeck would include more erratic and paranoid diary entries about new departments falsely accusing him of, quote, malfeasance, and such claims were, quote, a hoax, frame-up, or communist plot. He further claimed he would not be held responsible for all the, quote, blown fuses, arrests, compromises, or serious embarrassments to the State Department, that he would be revealed to, quote, protect ourselves and our people.
Okay, well, that sounds like a defense that would come from somebody who's rather concerned because, it's a communist plot. Why would the communists be plotting against him if they don't really know his agenda? What do you think of that?
Yeah, well, and I think that that's what helps feed what he passes on to McCarthy. It's his desperation in trying to save the pond that ultimately begins to convince him and kind of turn him, like Angleton in the later days, from rationality.
Okay. Well, there you go. See, again, paranoia is helpful and healthy to a degree. But once you get too wrapped up in certain things, you start playing pretty much like the game that we just played regarding counterintelligence, right? Sometimes counterintelligence is not the most useful methodology. And sometimes, it's not necessarily a communist plot. is against, it could be just something entirely different, but if that's your main focus, sometimes you get steeped in these things and, well, paranoia grows out of control, right?
Yeah. Yeah, okay. Someone just focuses on one figure and they become obsessed.
There you go. Okay.
So, or in Grombeck's case, a group.
Right. Well, that's the thing. Is a boogeyman one way or another, whether it's an individual or a group of people, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, good.
So, When Grombeck sought to leave the State Department, he went to G2, offering his group's return or suggesting perhaps the CIA would seek to sponsor them.
Mm.
The Army took him seriously, but the investigating Army officer responded to the pond's recent gathered material, calling it, quote, crap.
Ooh. Not good if you're not – listen, and here's the thing. If it was useful in their minds, they probably would have utilized it.
If there was any. I mean, and let's look at some of the things they've okayed, really. I mean, some of the bad ideas that the military and the intelligence agencies have okayed over the years.
Absolutely.
So they'll look for anything they can use, no matter how far-fetched.
So it must have been deemed completely useless. I mean,
yeah.
Let's be honest.
Yeah. So yeah, and you know, and I'm not saying that was all of their operations. Some of them were successful, but what they were running at the time when they reviewed it did not impress the military.
Mm. So there you go.
So this left Grombach and his group nearly without official funding or sponsorship, and during 1953, the descendant group of its greatest rival, the OSS, was petitioned to consider taking in the pond. The irony of this moment likely was not lost on Grombach and the Secretary of State, John Foster Dulles. When they were forced to hand over the organization to the CIA, the same rival that had been deceived about the continued existence of the pond.
Mm-hmm.
One official history notes, quote, "It must have been difficult for Grombach to subordinate himself to someone he found as loathsome as Alan Dulles, who in 1947 had testified before Congress in favor of centralizing clandestine collection in the CIA, directly opposing Grombach's testimony at the same hearing."
Right. Wow.
Over. Yeah, so he had to go hat in hand.
Yeah, I mean, okay, I know you wanted me gone, but I'm still here. Wow. Yeah, go ahead.
Over prior years regarding Alan Dulles, Grombach had claimed that the Gestapo, quote, had covered him like a tent when referring to Dulles' time in the OSS. He decried in one private letter, quote, "egomania of a really stupid and morally dishonest, though allegedly religious family called Dulles."
Hmm. Not entirely inaccurate.
Well, exactly. I've been making that contention about the younger Dulles for quite some time.
Mm, there you go.
You know, not quite the spy master when you look at his files. Mm. So legal proposals reveal that it was what Grombach did. He went to CIA Director Walter Bedell Smith, who sent the proposal to his subordinate Alan Dulles for review, and Dulles assigned the inspection of the pond to agency officer and future inspector general, Lyman Kirkpatrick. So now we have some familiar names coming in.
Oh, yes.
Where everything starts to connect. We're starting to see, like, where those lines we talked about, where they're not clear of demarcation, where now they become a little clearer, where everything joins together.
Right, right.
So an agreement was signed between the related parties. The pond was adopted by the agency, and this might have annoyingly planted the anti-communist group of officials that made Alan Dulles look socialist in comparison within its ranks.
Mm-hmm. See, and here we go with the anti-communist influence, leading to a lot of bad ideas. MK Ultra? Just saying. You know,
Blue Bird, Blue Book.
Blue Book, yeah, okay, fair enough.
I would not be surprised if some of the people from the pond who jumped ship when it went down or jumped ship, you know, in the intermittent time, were some of those people.
Mm-hmm.
Or at least influenced some of those people. Because there was no direct connection, they were still interacting in some ways, and some of those ideas filtered into CIA proper.
Well, it had to have.
Yeah.
I mean, there's just no two ways about it. So here we go. Okay. We have, about 11, 12 minutes left. So,
okay.
You know, I will leave it to you.
Okay. So it is the pond was adopted by the agency, and it is possible that the CIA would itself come under later attack during the Red Scare by information provided by the very group it was sponsoring. There is no reason to believe Grombach would not continue his goal of removing all communist influences from the U.S. intelligence structure by any means at his disposal. A central point of contention between the pond and the CIA was the former group's unwillingness to name sources to the CIA, which I think is a hilarious argument considering all the methods and sources arguments we hear these days.
Yeah, that is kind of funny, but yeah, you're not allowed to know our methods and sources.
Okay. Only we're allowed to do that.
Yeah.
A CIA history states, quote, "Lyman Kirkpatrick later wrote that the pond tended to change source descriptions on the rather paranoid grounds we would be able to discover the real source if they provided identical descriptions. This, of course, only served to make the agency desire to learn the secret's information more, and a similar problem they too later would deal with."
Mm.
While the agency desired an independent source check, the pond objected to exposing sources and methods. Grombach stated, quote, "Even if sources were divulged, CIA's concepts are so violently monopolistic and competitive that it uses dishonest, unethical, and ridiculous means to eliminate reports, discover and sabotage operations, and attempt to discover and take over systems, nets, and sources in the field." Which is true.
Mm. Yeah, no, I can't argue with him. Go ahead.
Unlike some of Grombach's more notable unreasonable fears, the official terms... Even the official history terms these fears of the CIA's desire to monopolize collection of intelligence perfectly rational. Yeah. A standard practice utilized by the agency was to obtain a source of information and then take over the source from a rival or enemy group. This eliminates the need to deal with a third party or face information limitations such as the POND applied to its reports.
Yeah, see, but here's the problem, though. Even filing these reports and, you know... Creating a cross-referencing system is difficult now, though, if you're going to keep switching the description of the sources. Now, how do you combine this is coming from the same source, this is coming from the same source? Maybe the source is no good. Maybe the information is no good. Like, how do you...
Yeah, it's almost impossible to do it. Yeah. I'm not saying the CIA wasn't right for wanting to do that, because if you want to have a functional system, you have to. But
you need to know your family tree. You need to know from whence this came and how it got passed to you in order to, you know the efficacy of the information. I'm going to side with the CIA here?
Yeah, every blue moon, maybe.
Yeah. Okay, go ahead.
Well, you know, look at the alternative. Lesser of two evils.
Wow. Yeah, well, we got the mafia. We got serial killers. All right, then.
Got it.
Good.
So another issue of information sharing is while the POND restricted the agency to some information, it had been providing the FBI with copies of its counterintelligence reports since 1942.
Mm.
Which I'm sure that stung.
Yeah, that's got to be. Okay.
But seemingly the POND's chief had a much better relationship with Hoover than later CIA directors enjoyed with him, and it was due to a long-existing cooperation. When the POND's leadership provided the FBI with a copy of Director Smith's, quote, "frank comments about U.S. intelligence community," I wish I could read that. I so wish I could read whatever that was.
Oh, wow. Yeah, I wonder.
Dell Smith commenting on everybody. Oh, my God. Could you imagine what he said about Dulles?
I don't even... That's just one of those things we can't have, huh?
Oh, I'm sure.
Yeah.
If I get it, I'll definitely share it with all you guys.
Oh, yeah. But, I would love to hear that.
Yeah, there's gonna be some vulgarity.
there has to be, right? His frank comments.
Yes.
Oof. Okay.
The CIA ordered the POND to stop providing embarrassing information to the FBI, but Grombach would not listen, and he notified the FBI of a future CIA attempt seeking to prevent him from reviewing some classified information.
Nice. So he's working against his own sponsor agency to maintain his relationship with Hoover and the FBI. That's what it boils down to, am I right?
Yeah, and this is going on during some of the roughest Cold War operations.
This is like the Second World War where we're trying to figure out what Stalin's really going to do and everything. And
the Cold War is just getting going.
Oh, man.
And while they're trying to land on their feet to do other things, they've got to deal with this guy undercutting them.
Nice. Go ahead.
When Alan Dulles replaced Bedell Smith, it left Grombach in the worst of all worlds. He was faced with a disapproving civilian boss that was highly critical of the POND's methods and operations. The POND's leader would continue providing other groups with derogatory intelligence on CIA personnel and others who he suspected served the agency. Mm-hmm. The CIA had a problem with securing information created by one of the very groups it used to collect intelligence, and its director was a hated rival of a subordinate organization the agency funded. It was then fearing no further sponsoring group would emerge when the POND CIA contract ended. Grombach approached associates of rabid anti-communist U.S. Senator Joseph McCarthy. Mm. McCarthy would prove to be the ringmaster of a series of unfair hearings that mocked the American system of justice, fueled in some instances by reports provided by Grombach's organization via reporters and aligned lawyers. Grombach in one letter even offered to place pond at the disposal of the U.S. Congress during the Red Scare. Among the notable names that would later emerge in later communist hunting days would be Elger Hiss, who was accused of being a communist spy ring, in a communist spy ring and found guilty of perjury. Notably, following the fall of the Soviet Union under review by Russian historians and military intelligence, it did not reveal any additional information in their related files. But later files found after 2000 did support he was guilty. I would contend the lesson with Hiss and others accused is not that they were innocent always, but denied any presumption of innocence. Everyone deserves a fair trial under the law.
Well, I would also argue that his case in and of itself is a fascinating study. And regardless of the documentation that emerged later, I would say that, first of all, that he was denied due process.
Yeah, no presumption. If they don't give him presumption of innocence, they've denied him due process.
Right. I mean, that's the automatic issue, but there's more to it. I'm not sufficiently convinced that Hiss was guilty, to be honest.
Well, no, I'm not saying he had to be. I'm just saying they supported that he was guilty.
Oh, no,
now,
no,
whether or not he is guilty, we still don't know.
Oh, I understand. I'm just entering my objection that I don't believe that he was, and I urge people to take a look at the Hiss case separately. And examine it very carefully and see what was done there. And again, this is, you know, here we go. Wait, Roy Cohn comes in here somewhere, doesn't he?
Yeah. Well, Cohn was one of the people that Grombeck's intermediaries dealt with.
See, you know, this is how a lot of things wind up tying back together. So, Carmine, I think that this is a great end spot, actually, because it takes us straight into the time. Go ahead.
I was going to say, just I've got 1.5 more paragraphs.
but you know what? We're kind of out of time,
okay.
And it's a nice logical end.
And this is basically where I was going to. It was just going to, you know, add a little extra to it. But yeah, basically we end in the Red Scare.
Yeah, I mean that's effectively where, you know. Listen, we can deposit it all there because after the Red Scare, where's the pond? You know.
Well, yeah. It's gone within a couple of years.
Yeah. So, I mean, quite honestly,
he basically destroyed all of his allies.
Yeah, he destroyed all of his allies, even the ones that were sponsoring him. You know,
The last thing I just want to throw in is the way that it goes down. I'll summarize. Basically, Dulles realizes that Grombeck is a threat. He puts Angleton on him to catch his net using a marked card, basically. They catch how he's doing it, and they expose it by feeding disinformation to McCarthy. McCarthy gets discredited, and then he goes down with him.
There you go. And, yeah, so that's what it comes down to here is, and quite frankly, you know what? It's interesting because, again, if you had not had the disillusionment of his agency, you might not have had that same desperation well up and end up in the hands of McCarthy.
Mm-hmm.
We might not have the term McCarthyism without this guy, quite frankly.
Yeah.
The CIA might have been busy doing some other things had they not taken that agency in. Had that agency not been picked up by the CIA, we got a whole other issue here. So, you know, and who knows where that would have went. There have been various intelligence operations that were temporary agencies that were created, and they served a purpose for a time, but then that was the end of that. This one is rather weird because there is a resonant effect, and I find this entire discussion extremely remarkable, to say the least. So, Carmine, I'm going to like kind of end things off here. I'll give you the final word, but quite frankly, this is a fascinating discussion, and like I said, the pond or pond scum is definitely going to have to make it into the algorithms out there. I think it'll help carry it somehow. Besides that, I just want to see, you know, the title pond scum on YouTube pop up when they automatically load it. So that's definitely going in there. Again, really, really brilliant stuff. And I am sorry I cut you off a little early, but I think the point is made, and it is a very interesting history that links to so many other parts of history, which we could discuss on this show at any time. I mean, we could discuss the McCarthy hearings. We could discuss the Hiss case one night if you want.
Yeah, Pietro. There's a lot of stuff in there.
Pietro's got to be like a multi-part series. This dude, man. I mean, I don't know how much information is available on him, but the serial killer doctor who's stealing blankets, who's used as an intelligence asset. What?
Yeah.
Too much.
Who gets arrested by the Gestapo right. for helping Jewish people when he's actually killing them.
When he's actually killing them and collecting their riches and yikes. Anyway, so all of that, Carmine, what do you think? I think we did a really good job here, and you mostly, because, you know, I'm just here adding commentary. And quite frankly, I did not know probably 60% or 70% of what you discussed tonight. Quite frankly, I just had a little bit of general commentary to add, and I know I slowed you down a little bit, but I think we got a pretty good show out of this, and I'm real happy with it. So, anyways, anything you want to say before we close it out?
Well, I just hope everybody enjoyed it, and it's good to be back again, and it's certainly interesting. And this, I think, what's interesting about this is that it's sometimes the forgotten groups that end up being just as important. Because if you consider it, the Pond outlived the OSS, the SSU, the CIG, all the groups everybody knows.
Mm-hmm. That's true. And quite frankly, if you think about the influence of the Red Scare in and of itself,
yeah.
That is a significant part of history that was, you know, kicked into motion, you know, kind of like this is the cue ball hitting the seven. Going, sending your trick shot in, it is part of the roots of history.
Actions have consequences.
Actions always have. Every action has an equal reaction. All right, anyway, I'm not doing that. But Carmine, great to have you along, man. I can't wait to see what we're going to do in another 2 weeks because usually you bring this, and I love having you on. TPAAK.com is Carmine's website. I urge you to go there. You'll learn a lot more than you did tonight. But also you can learn about tonight's subject and many, many others over there. Anyway, for those of you, no matter who you are, where you are, remember this. I'm Mirlio Celli. All of you are actually the effect. Good night.